The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of The Dan Proft Show. Thanks so much for joining us. Happy to have you as we are... struck with some optimism after yesterday's announcement of the guidelines in three phases for reopening America's economy, freeing people from their shelter-in-place orders. Of course, this will go governor by governor, state by state, as President Trump outlined in his address.
Based on the latest data, our team of experts now agrees that we can begin the next front in our war, which we are calling opening up America again. Our approach outlines three phases in restoring our economic life. We are not opening all at once, but one careful step at a time. And some states will be able to open up sooner than others. Some states are not in the kind of trouble that others are in. Healthy Americans will now be able to return to work as conditions on the ground allow. Instead of a blanket shutdown, we will pursue a focus on sheltering the highest risk individuals, so important. We're establishing clear scientific metric and benchmarks on testing, new case growth and hospital capacity that must be met before advancing to each phase. Throughout the process, citizens will continue to be called upon to use all of their weapons in this war. Vigorous hygiene, teleworking when possible, staying at home if you feel sick, maintaining social distance, sanitizing commonly used surfaces, and being highly conscious of their surroundings.
So it's not over, and nobody's saying it is, starting with the president, in terms of preparing for the mischaracterizations of this. You heard from him, the included in the guidelines, the phased reopening is all the preventative measures that will still be taken. Phase one, this from the slides presented, mitigate the risk of resurgence. Public venues allowed to be open, again, per the governors. He made that clear. Arenas, theaters, restaurants, houses of worship, under certain social distancing conditions. However, all vulnerable individuals should continue to shelter in place. And as you go from phase to phase, as Dr. Birx detailed, the progression would be related to 14 days of decreasing evidence of illness. Evidence of illness is the phrase, not just caseload. Evidence of illness. So trajectories matter. The full complement of the available data matters in terms of building the evidentiary case to go from one phase to the other. Phase two, it opens up a little bit more. Hospitals, nursing homes, some locations still remain off limits. But schools, importantly here, schools, daycare centers, camps can reopen. Non-essential travel can resume. And then phase three is even more wide open, fewer restrictions than phase two. Even vulnerable individuals would have more freedom but should still practice social distancing, less shelter in place. So that's sort of the progression. And look, it's broad guidelines combined with best practices, and governors and local officials are going to have to make their own calls. That's how the system works. That's the only way it's going to work. And as we've discussed on this show with guests over the last several days, look, ultimately, this rises or falls at the local level, the interpersonal level, employers and employees, neighborhoods, school communities. It's going to have to be a collaborative process. It's not going to be top down waiting to be told what to do from the president, much obviously, but even your governor, your state legislators, your local mayors, your city councilmen. You know, it's got to be best practices, a framework, and then common sense. Joe Biden, fascinating. Joe Biden went on CNN to respond to the president's plan. And remember this moment and the reaction you got from Joe Biden, particularly remember it in context.
Well, I wouldn't call it a plan. I think what he's done, he's kind of punted. He's decided that he doesn't have the right to make the call for the country. And he talks about phases that, in a generic sense, seem to me, from all I've learned and all I've listened in my morning briefs from the docs I talk to, is not irrational, but it doesn't give you any hard guidelines.
By the way, the docs that Joe Biden talks to each morning have nothing to do with politics or policy. I can almost guarantee you that. With respect to what he said, punting. This is punting? No, the Constitution is what doesn't give Trump the authority to impose his will. Despite what he declared earlier this week, which I've criticized, declaring himself the sole sovereign, that is not the case. And he knows it, and those around him know it. Which is why it's been, as I suggested, guidelines in, guidelines out. Guidelines in, guidelines out. That's the way it should be. That's what abides the Constitution. That's what abides federal law. That's what abides state police power, Joe Biden. And it's remarkable he would say such a thing. But remember that he said this. He's criticizing Trump, who the left says wants to be king, except when they're complaining that he doesn't want to be a king. He's criticizing Trump for not exceeding his constitutional authority to impose his will on states. You know, is that what you would do, Vice President Biden, if you were president? I'm sure some governors and populations of the 50 states would like to know. But Joe Biden's got a lot of other big ideas, too, if only he could remember them.
You know, there's a during World War Two, where Roosevelt came up with a thing that was totally different World War II. He had the War Production Board.
Oh, right. That's it. The War Production Board. Why isn't Trump used the War Production Board? Pandemic Production Board. Well, he's got the Defense Production Act, which he has invoked, whether you agree or not, he has, with respect to General Motors, with respect to 3M. So, you know, Biden is lurching around in the dark for ways to legitimately criticize President Trump and whiffing. He also said this in terms of the standard here for I don't know exactly what actually. I don't know if this is his standard for reopening or what when he says this.
You know, this isn't going to be over until we have a vaccine.
Well, I know it's not going to be over until we have a vaccine or it's not going to or we want drug therapies as well as ultimately a vaccine. But that, according to all of the experts, is a year to year and a half away. So what does that mean? It's not going to be over. We know it's not going to be over. So you propose what exactly? Shelter in place orders that imposed on the states by you, Imperial Lord Joe Biden? Because, right, you think you can exceed the Constitution if you're president to demand what states would do. Otherwise, your criticism of Trump is without foundation. And number two, it's not going to be over until we have a vaccine. We all want a vaccine and we all want it tomorrow, but we know it's not coming tomorrow. So what do you plan for us to do between now and a year to a year and a half from now? In the best case scenario. And the vaccine, we have a flu shot, we have a flu vaccine. It's 50% effective. Is 50% effective good enough? Boy, a lot of questions that Joe Biden's comments prompt, don't they? And then, of course, you have at the state level the disparate approaches, don't you? From budding authoritarians like Gretchen Whitmer to those that have more faith and trust in their constituents. Peggy Noonan tackles that topic in her piece, which is very good. I want to just focus on the political piece of it, the sense of give that she argues politicians need to have, not just politicians, but also politicians. She writes, in politics, when you're praised for something, it becomes your move, then your only move. That's what you're seeing when you see Tony Evers in Wisconsin without foundation. I mean, it's just madness. Extend the shelter in place order until May 26th. In politics, when you're praised for something, praised for draconian measures, it becomes your move, then your only move. The governors are experiencing new power and fame and can give in to the lure of the dumb. What is needed is a sense of proportion and crucially respect for your people. Michigan's governor misstepped this week when she ordered, among other things, restrictions on the sale of garden supplies in big box stores. Governor shouldn't be so granular. Leaders need to think big and have some give. When rules seem punitive and capricious, trust thins, and people who are already under pressure get mad. That's what you're seeing happen. And I know there's been a real benefit for overreacting, stoking fear, imposing draconian strictures. And these governors, Whitmer, Evers, and so many others have seen their popularity, their approval rating soar. Well, Peggy Noonan is blowing the warning horn for them. Because, like the market, just as quickly as they've soared over the last several weeks, they can tank. So Tony Evers in Wisconsin, for example, just to move off Gretchen Whitmer for a moment, Tony Evers may be at his apex right now. Talk to me in 6 weeks. Talk to me at the end of May if he doesn't relent on his shutdown order and where people are at in terms of their economic lives in a state that is not even in the top 20 in COVID-19 related fatalities. This is Dan Proft. She blinded me with science. She
blinded me with science. Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Sticking on the states, per our discussion before the break, David Marcus, our friend over at TheFederalist.com, has a good piece this week on Chris Cuomo. But I also want to talk about his brother, Andrew Cuomo. How is it that the governor of the state with, by far and away, the largest outbreak of the virus, and I'm not blaming Andrew Cuomo for this, the way that the left blames Trump for the spread of the virus, I'm not blaming him for it. But I am sort of curious how the chief executive of the state with by far the largest outbreak, by far the largest number of fatalities, is also being covered as if he's General George Patton. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid David Marcus. He is a New York correspondent for The Federalist. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Can you help me with that? How Chris Cuomo, his management of this has been an unqualified success?
Andrew Cuomo.
Andrew Cuomo, how his management has been an unqualified success.
It gets confusing even for us here in New York.
Yes.
You know, because, of course, their dad was also the governor at one point. Listen, I think that both Cuomo and Trump have been pretty effective in the press conferences in the sense of really their candor. And I think that you're absolutely right that New York and especially New York City got slammed. You know, that's in large part because we live right on top of each other and we use this subway system that's just a petri dish for these kinds of viruses. But, you know, you're right that there's a double standard at work here. But I think both of them have done a pretty good job getting themselves out in front of the people and, you know, trying to be as straightforward as they can about what's really going on.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, I'm not trying to cheap shot Andrew Cuomo. It's just that it's the standard of analysis, I guess, is what baffles me. But since you wrote about Chris, too, now that his wife has tested positive, and I'm sorry that occurred. I hope she's fine, just as I hope he's fine. But these interactions he has with the public and this existential crisis he's apparently going through on his Sirius radio show are just bizarre. I don't know why he and his wife are getting in the business of accosting some bike rider on Easter Sunday any more than he got in a fight over somebody calling him Fredo several months back. And I just find this. And by the way, his routine with Andrew Cuomo on CNN is not cute, and it's not the moment to be cute either.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think a lot of this stuff is stuff that probably plays a lot better in New York than it does in the rest of the country on some level. It's what we're used to. I mean, it gets a little cutesy. I mean, as to Chris Cuomo's existential crisis, I actually thought that some of what he said made some sense in terms of like just how performative the news media has become.
Yeah, sure.
And I think there's criticism to be leveled at both sides on that. I think both you and I can probably look at situations where we haven't been the best as far as that goes.
Sure.
So, you know, I actually thought that was kind of insightful and good stuff for us all to think about.
It would have been more powerful if he didn't immediately backtrack and say, no,
yeah.
I love CNN.
I still want
to make
Zucker,
millions of dollars. Yeah.
Yeah. When Jeff Zucker's standing there with his checkbook, you know, things get a little different.
You also talked about the lockdown loosening, and that loosening is happening whether people want it to or not. And, you know, there's some observations this week. Of course, a lot of the focus was on Michigan, but it wasn't just Michigan where people are growing weary of having their lives micromanaged for them by the political ruling elites in their respective states. We've seen protests in Columbus, Ohio, and more are coming. And I think probably next to be hit the hardest in terms of protesting is Wisconsin after Tony Evers extended the shutdown order until May 26. But when you make these dire predictions that they don't come true for whatever reason, you can understand when people start to get antsy, and politicians are going to need to start understanding that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, even a week ago, if you were even talking about the economic crisis that is really staring down the barrel at us, you know, you were considered, you know, awful or a ghoul, or how can you think about the economy at a time like this? You know, and I think the American people have spoken in a real way, especially in the middle of the country, saying, listen, these are our communities. These are our small businesses. We can't just go on like this forever. So I think what the White House announced yesterday, what a lot of the governors are talking about, makes sense. You know, it's a sensible way to start going about reopening. And as I wrote in my piece, ultimately the American people are going to decide on that, because this has been, you know, this has been much more something that the American people have consented to than something that's been enforced.
Right.
And I don't know how you enforce it.
Well, and the other thing that's happened this week, too, is I think you started to get into a second wave of unemployment with the 5 million plus new first time unemployment claims. Now you're starting to get into some white collar jobs, sales jobs at big companies. It's not just frontline workers at restaurants and hotels.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, as the longer this goes on, the more devastating it's going to be for, you know, more and more people, including the media companies that are covering the stories, you know, I mean, for everybody. So, we're definitely past the point where the economic part of this not part of the conversation. That's why I thought it was so good this week that the White House did create this other council really focused on reopening the economy, because you can't blame the medical experts for only being focused on saving lives. That's their job. That's
right.
What they should be doing. They
mm-hmm.
they shouldn't be thinking about small businesses, but somebody should be thinking about that. So I think that's why that council made a lot of sense.
And and thankfully we have you to think about how to best decide to take up smoking to fight COVID-19.
Right.
This is just a remarkable piece. 5 tips for taking up smoking to fight coronavirus. Explain the backstory here.
Well, it's, you know, as it says right up on the top, this is a humor piece. I'm
yes.
certainly not suggesting
yes.
that anybody should take up smoking. I mean, the backstory is there have been a handful of really counterintuitive studies that show that smokers, for some reason, are less vulnerable to certain aspects of the virus or whatever. So I just kind of went off that. Like it was kind of like the reverse of like the jogging guru who was found dead of a heart attack like while jogging. Kind of the opposite of that. So I figured if this is what you wanted, I smoke. So I figured if there were people who wanted to, you know, take up smoking to protect themselves, I might be able to give them some tips.
I figured it was a recruitment tool. I figured at least it was in part
right.
at least a recruitment tool. No, you know, we need a little levity in these moments, too, especially well-crafted levity, which that was. David Marcus, New York correspondent for The Federalist, TheFederalist.com. David, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Take care. It's the number one political documentary of 2019. It's No Safe Spaces, produced by our colleague and friend Dennis Prager, as well as Adam Carolla, putting together a story of the assault on free speech that's happening in American society on college campuses, through social media platforms, of course, in Hollywood. No Safe Spaces details this. It also provides instruction as to what you can do to stand for free minds and free speech in a free society, that free society called America. Check it out now while you have some downtime. Watch it with the family. No Safe Spaces for a limited time at nosafespaces.com.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Who is reading the electorate better, Trump or Pelosi? And I'm not just talking about PPP funding, but I am also talking about PPP funding, the Forgive a Loan Program for small businesses. I want to go back to this observation from Alex Tabarrok, a professor of economics at George Mason University, over at March on Revolution, a blog that he and Tyler Cohen operate. From the point of view of non-elites, the elites with their models and data and projections have shut the economy down. The news is full of pleas for New York, which always seemed like a suspicious den of urban inequity, but their hometown is doing fine. The church is closed, the bar is closed, the local plan is closed, money is tight. Meanwhile, the elites are laughing about binging Tiger King on Netflix. It doesn't feel right. I can understand that, or feel that I must try to understand that. And he then posts some pictures of protests in Columbus, Ohio, which Mike DeWine certainly took to heart in announcing May 1 would be the beginning of their reopening. So that's part of what Trump is reading. Now, compare and contrast this with something a little bit earlier this week that has been circulating online as a Nancy Pelosi's Marie Antoinette moment. This is with James Corden on one of those insufferable late night shows.
Speaker Pelosi, what have you found? What are you going to share with us from your home?
Chocolate.
Really?
Chocolate.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the episode of Cribs I never knew I needed. Oh, my. Wow.
Other people in our family go for some other flavors, but chocolate, and then we have some other chocolate here.
She's also standing in front of, she's standing in front of two huge stainless steel refrigerators that, at least according to the online pricing, are upwards of 25 grand. But it's just a fun old time, isn't it? Meanwhile, over 4 weeks, 22 million plus Americans filed first-time unemployment, which puts that number, as I keep saying, since that's a lagging indicator, probably closer to 30 million. The University of Chicago study we talked about yesterday that suggests that two-thirds of the American workforce cannot work from home. So you tell me who's got a better handle on the American electorate, the American people, Trump or Pelosi? Or maybe they both have a handle on their constituencies. And whose constituency do you think will end up being bigger? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Brett Baer, Fox News anchor. Of course, he is the host of Special Report. He's also the best-selling author, number one best-selling author, 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Perhaps Brett Baer can provide some instruction to Joe Biden about FDR and World War II, since he was trying to come up with what FDR did during World War II on CNN yesterday. Brett, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
You know, I've had somebody tell me they've read over this little quarantine all three days books. So that's impressive.
There you go.
it's an option.
It's a time for looking for, you know, historical context and precedents from the annals of American history to put this into some, you know, sort of to put this in some sort of context.
It is. And listen, this is a time like we've never seen before. It is unprecedented. Now, the going inclination is that you don't want to underreact to a deadly virus, but there is a teetering point here of, as you're talking about, 22 million Americans. I mean, it's quite something. And if you think about that small business program, the PPP, they had 1.6 million loans go up, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are 30 million plus small businesses. And the whole battle about whether to restock that fund with $250 billion really starts to look bad as they actually run out of money as of yesterday. So Democrats, for all the positioning where they say, you know, Trump has screwed up from the beginning, and they're casting all of the things. And there's no doubt that there were fits and starts, and he said some things that dialed things back. Right now, what is happening, what they're doing, Democrats may be on the wrong side of that positioning.
Well, and Jim Jordan tweeting out in furtherance of that position that House Democrats think they can give states federal grant money funded by American taxpayers to free prisoners and defeat coronavirus, but not to small businesses. That's a problem. That's a bad juxtaposition, I would think, for Democrats.
Yeah, I think that this moment is turning the tide a little bit. I do think, listen, the blueprint yesterday presented by Dr. Birx and the president gives states, you know, the checkpoints. What it doesn't give them is the tests. You know, they're just not there. Maybe they'll be there. But for all the talk about, you know, we're going to have these tests in CVS parking lots, and there's going to be this and this and this and tests at home, they're just not there yet. And while they're talked about, they're just not mass produced. So that's the way that all these states get to the point where they can feel comfortable that they're making the right choice.
When we come back with Fox News' Brett Baer, I'll ask about his reporting and that of his network on the Wuhan Virology Lab. More with Brett Baer when we return.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Fox News' Brett Baer, host of Special Report, and you and your colleagues at Fox News have been on this story since the beginning. This is the investigation into the Wuhan Virology Lab, the possibility that the virus may have originated at that lab and then spread from there. Can you elaborate on what you and your colleagues at Fox News have found regarding this?
Our intel folks and sources that we're talking to say that it's not conclusive. They don't have conclusive information, but they do have increasing amounts of open source and classified material that point directly to that Wuhan lab for a messed up handling of this virus. China was doing all kinds of things looking at coronavirus in that lab. Not that they're building it genetically. This particular virus genetically, as they look at the map of the genome structure, is natural. So that it would have been studied and then jumped naturally in the lab and then gotten out to the population of Wuhan is something that they're increasingly looking at just by the amount of evidence that they're seeing. They can't make that conclusive judgment, but they can make the conclusion that right at the beginning, China did everything it could to cover up and to delay. And had their actions been changed, even a week before, but definitely 2 weeks before, they would have been able likely to contain it to one area, that Wuhan province. So that's what they're looking at. And, you know, it's not being talked about as a bioweapon, but as a major mistake that China obviously knew about early on because of the actions that followed.
Help me reconcile something here. So Washington Post reported earlier in the week, 2018 memos coming from diplomats saying we have concerns about what's happening at this virology lab in Wuhan. And the point of the Post article was somehow the Trump administration was asleep at the switch as it pertains to that, whatever was happening at that lab, and they got cables to that effect. However, then we subsequently learn that in 2018, the National Institute for Health, the Infectious and Allergy Division, which is headed by Tony Fauci, provided a $3.7 million grant that included those researchers at that Wuhan lab to specifically study coronavirus and bat coronavirus even more specifically. So our NIH is funding research at that lab. At the same time, diplomats are saying we have concerns about what's happening at that lab.
Yeah, so there was a program called Prevent that was designed to have Americans train the Chinese. And that's where that funding came from. The Canadians were involved as well. It was actually the French that set up the lab. But that happens prior to the U.S. officials going to see what that lab looks like. And the lab is given a rating of 4, a bio facility 4, which is the highest. But those U.S. officials who go there and see it and interact with the Chinese say it's not operating like that. It's operating like a 2, which is much less secure, hence the emails and the warnings, and that's all confirmed. And you add that to the early days where Wuhan has a 40,000 person dinner, like banquet for the lunar celebration. They've got all these people going through that area for this celebration, and President Xi doesn't make an announcement until after that is all done.
But I just want to, so you got to after the fact, after the grant, and they're on site and they see that it's not as secure as it should be. So then cables are sent. But does Tony Fauci take that to a CDC director Redfield or to the White House directly, or does Redfield take it to the White House? I mean, what's the chain of custody of these cables, and who knew when, so that we have some sense of the awareness that there was a problem there?
This is really a big part of the investigation. The one part of the investigation is to get more conclusive evidence, whether classified or not, that they can put it at the lab. But the second part of the investigation is, what did we do with that knowledge internally in the government, whether in the epidemiology, you know, realm, or in the government itself, in the administration? The Intel folks said that it was sending red alarms when those cables came back, but it does not appear that anything happened as a result. Remember, you know, during this time leading up to this crisis, you know, we're in negotiations with China on trade and getting a phase 2 deal. So there's, you know, and Hong Kong is happening, and the Hong Kong, you know, pushback is happening basically because of the makeup of the bat and the virus and how it transfers.
Yeah, but this is why you have people in specific lanes, right? So Tony Fauci, this is his agency's money and Redfield's money. They should be exercising oversight. So this is to me why the questions that should be asked directly of the people that are in this lane, responsible for this lane, because there's all sorts of people operating in all sorts of lanes, and then they all converge at the Oval Office and on the Hill. But there needs to be accountability at the agency level.
This is also then where WHO factors in.
Yes, right.
It doesn't.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, so they're kind of overseeing the whole thing too, and, you know, obviously are not playing a role in concerns about it. And the early days, you know, with the rollout of what happened, there's a growing confidence in the U.S. government that the WHO was complicit.
Right.
And that is when you lead to what has happened with the funding.
He is Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, hosts a special report, as you know, 5 p.m. Chicago time, when he's not preempted by the task force briefings. Hopefully those will be coming to an end sometime soon, because the virus's lethality is coming to an end sometime soon. He's also the number one best-selling author of 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Get all the 3 Days books when you pick up that one. Brett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And I just wanted to point to this extended look at the job market that the Wall Street Journal did. It's it presents a couple of silver linings. It's not good, as everybody knows, but just in terms of silver linings, where does this go? What does the recovery look like? How much of a V recovery can we anticipate? I mean, it's unprecedented to have 22 million plus first-time unemployment filers in this period of time we've had, 4 weeks. By comparison, the 2007 to 2009 recession, you didn't get to 20 million until sort of halfway through the recession, which lasted 80 weeks. You never got to 22 million first-time unemployment filers, 22 million unemployed in the 2001 recession or the 1990 recession, both which lasted 9 months. So it is unprecedented. And also this, just to give you a sense of spread, if you will, a survey conducted by ZipRecruiter in late March shows nearly 47% of employed respondents said they had their hours cut due to the pandemic. This is across sector. So this looked at, you know, accommodations and restaurants, retail, wholesale, transportation, warehousing, education, construction, professional business services, finance and insurance, manufacturing, information, technology. All those sectors, to give you a sort of a representative look, ideally. 47% total across all sectors, nearly half of the employed population. Not surprisingly, restaurants, hotel accommodations fared the worst at nearly 80%, all the way down to information technology, which is in the neighborhood of 30%. Here's the good news. Okay, that's the bad news. Here's the good news. In California, again, this is from survey work, California, 7% of the 122,000 layoffs that occurred in March and April are being deemed permanent. These are from layoff reports submitted by large employers to state labor bureaus in accordance with the federal law. Just 7% in California deemed permanent. Similarly, employers in Colorado and Washington who have reported a combined 23,000 layoffs so far in 2020, far exceeding the number of unemployed they announced in 2008 or 2009 during the last recession, the Great Recession. Nearly three-quarters of the cuts in 2020 of the 23,000 layoffs, nearly three-quarters are deemed temporary. Compare that to less than 1% deemed temporary in 2008 and 2009. The upshot is this. The Great Recession, companies looked to restructure their businesses, rethink their employment generally. What some of the early indications are, and perhaps in part because of the payroll protection program, is that, at least for now, most companies are looking to ride out the storm. They're looking to weather this and return to where their business was prior to the outbreak and the shutdowns, where their business was in terms of the number of people employed and its general operation. So hopefully that will be the case, and hopefully that provides a little bit of optimism to some people who have been currently displaced from their positions.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us, danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes, Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. Here's what Dr. Tony Fauci had to say at the briefing yesterday, in which the three-phased guidelines for reopening were presented.
Fact mitigation works. You saw the charts. And what we hope, and I believe we will be successful, if we carefully do this again, with the attention to the safety and health of the American public, that we will be able to. It will be staggered. Not every state, not every region is going to do it at the same time. That's clearly obvious because of the varied dynamics of the outbreak. We will get to the point, hopefully sooner, with safety as the most important thing, to a point where we can get back to some form of normality. The one thing I liked about it that Dr. Birx said so well is that no matter what phase you're in, there are certain fundamental things that we've done that are not like it was in September and October. You want to call it the new normal, you can call it whatever you want. But even if you are in phase one, two, three, it's not okay, game over. It's not. It's going to be a way that we protect ourselves because, as we know, and as I've said from this podium, it may very well be, as we go the cycle around, that there'll be this virus that wants to come back to us. I think we're going to be able to handle that. Thank you.
Phase one, designed to mitigate the risk of resurgence, as you heard Fauci describing, would allow public venues such as arenas, theaters, restaurants, places of worship to open under certain social distancing conditions while suggesting that all vulnerable individuals should continue to shelter in place. And then it gets better as you move through the phases, obviously. Birx's phrase was each phase would be related to 14 days of decreasing evidence of illness. So that's broader than just cases. I want to use her words and take them specifically, take them literally. Decreasing evidence of illness, that's broader. So it's just worth noting. And then, of course, these are guidelines promulgated by the Fed. So what constitutes the manifest weight of the evidence might vary from state to state. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Dr. Robert Sintrenberg. He's an infectious disease specialist at Advocate Lutheran General in Park Ridge, Illinois. Dr. Sintrenberg, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it. Did the phases that were announced yesterday strike you as reasonable and appropriate?
Yes, I think they're reasonable. The problem is that we're drafting these as we go along, and they're subject to change. So I think it's important to have a plan, but also to understand that we can't be rigid about the plan, that as we get into it, it's very likely that things will change, depending on how we're doing with the disease.
Some encouraging news on the therapeutics front, the remdesivir trials at University of Chicago, the funding that Moderna is receiving for the development of a vaccine. Even some, again, anecdotal evidence about the effectiveness of HCQ, particularly with respect to some nursing home patients in Galveston County, Texas. How sanguine are you about at least the prospect of a therapeutic treatment for those who are infected before the summer is out?
I think there will be drug therapy that, once we study it with science, will be effective. The problem we've had so far is everyone's so desperate for a cure, and understandably, that many physicians are ordering drugs to treat these patients, not in any sort of controlled clinical trial. And that's a problem because you can't gauge the effectiveness unless you have a controlled clinical trial. So as we get further into the clinical trials that are being done, then we'll have a real idea of what the science is. We are hopeful that one or more of these trials will show benefit from drugs, whether it's remdesivir, which is the Gilead drug, or other drugs. We don't know yet. There is some anecdotal evidence that hydroxychloroquine works in some patients. We just don't know which patients that is yet. So I think drug therapy is going to be more important earlier than vaccine therapy.
Well, speaking of the science with respect to transmission, a couple of studies this week, one out of Hong Kong that finds that there was almost no instance of transmission outdoors. They looked at north of 300 cases in a particular region that was impacted by the virus and found that there was only one case where more than two people were infected. The great majority of cases, three infected or more, were in household settings, whether a family or people living together in close quarters, so the higher viral load. And then in addition to that, a study out of the Institute of Virology and HIV Research at the University of Bonn finds, looking at surveys across the Heinsberg region, where 1,400 confirmed cases have been reported in a population of about 250,000 inhabitants, 46 coronavirus-related deaths, no transmission of the virus in supermarkets, restaurants, or hairdressers. So what about the, I understand social distancing, but social distancing to the point that you can't go outside, you can't jog along the lakefront, you can't play golf, you can't play tennis, you can't go get your hair cut. Isn't there a viral load issue, too, that has sort of been underpresented?
Sure. And the concept you're talking about is true with many respiratory viruses, even a common cold, much more likely to be transmitted indoors than outdoors because it's a higher population density and less ventilation indoors. So that's a very valid point. And in terms of doing things outside, you can always go outside, and that's never been part of the shelter-in-place. The shelter-in-place order has never said, nor should it say, that you can't go outside. It's just you have to keep your distance. Just understanding how the virus is transmitted helps us figure out how to get back in there. So, again, the vast majority of transmission of this virus is by the respiratory route, by droplets that travel about 6 feet and then they drop to the ground. And so the primary and most by far most likely way you get this virus is by being within 6 feet of somebody who has a virus and is either coughing or talking loudly, can expel the virus that way. You can also get it from surfaces too. Somebody coughs onto a surface, you touch it, and then you touch your face, you can infect yourself. Probably a less common mechanism than the respiratory route. So anything you do socially, if you can keep your distance, if you can stay more than 6 feet away from someone, you're drastically reducing your chances of getting infected. So in terms of re-entering and things that you can do, certainly, you know, people are dying to get their hair cut because no one's had a haircut in a month. And so is it safe to go into a hair salon? Probably if you have social distancing, if the customer and the hairstylist are both wearing masks and taking appropriate precautions. But yeah, I think it's very reasonable. That's something that we can start to look at.
Good, because I'm starting to look like Dusty Hill from ZZ Top. Here's just one more thing, the maddening question on testing. So again, this week, President Trump talked about Abbott Labs coming online with the antibody test. They're going to be 20 million produced, distributed, so on and so forth. I don't understand why it's taking so long, particularly because I personally talked to an employee at, say, at for example, Chem Biodiagnostics out of Long Island that says we have a antibody test, and actually it's an antibody test which will test you for the virus. It will also test the level of antibodies you've developed if you were infected and asymptomatic, for example. And she tells me that other companies, her competitors, have tests as well. There's a Rutgers test that was talked about earlier in the week, then the Abbott Labs. Why is it taking so long, and why can't we and shouldn't we have been on parallel tracks for this entire time to do representative sample testing on both for both infection as well as the antibody tests, so we can better model the incidence of infection, the incidence of asymptomatic individuals, the potential upside of infection that could continue, so that we can make better policy decisions about reopening and everything else?
Sure. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. So we got entire country got a very, very late start on testing. We weren't prepared for this pandemic in terms of testing. You know, other countries, even places like South Korea, they were testing 10,000 people a day from the very beginning. We were nowhere near that. And it wasn't until about a month or 5 weeks ago that the private labs and the private companies got the go-ahead to develop their own tests. It seems like it's taking forever to get these tests out. First of all, in the last month, our testing capability has gone up dramatically. We are now able to test almost everybody we need to test. So we've actually improved. And I know it seems like a long time, but actually, pretty much all of these tests are being approved under emergency use authorization by the FDA. So it's a lot shorter time period than it normally is. So normally it takes several months at least to get these tests approved. They have to be validated. But every single test now is being pushed through under emergency use authorization. So the good news with that is that we get more tests out. The bad news is they haven't all been completely validated. So we don't know exactly how good all the tests are. It's certainly better to have tests than not, but we have to be a little bit cautious that we don't know all of the characteristics or the qualities of the individual tests. Now, with regard to the antibody testing that you're referring to, that could be a game changer in getting us back into society. So the antibody test can do two things. One, it can tell you who has the disease right now, but more importantly, it can tell you who had the disease. And all these people who feel like they had a flu-like illness in the past month or two, they may well have had COVID, and the antibody test will tell you that if you had it or not.
He is Dr. Robert Sinterberg. He's an infectious disease specialist at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. Dr. Sinterberg, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I'm doing all right, getting good grades. The future's so bright, I've got to wear shades.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and I saw the news yesterday. The PGA announced that it has plans to resume its season in June, but without any fans in attendance, much like it is for American soccer matches all the time, no fans. And I'm thinking about and watching states, unlike Illinois, that are reopening golf courses. Like even Wisconsin is, despite extending the shelter-in-place order through May 26th. And then I feel bad about myself when I read Christopher Rufo's pieces at City Journal. Like, isn't it nice to have downtown problems like golf courses being closed? And I mean that seriously, because this is, as we have discussed on this show often over the last several weeks, this is really the pandemic and the response to it and the impact of the shutdown is accentuating the inequalities in American society. It is hitting people at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum much harder than people at the upper end, just as we said it would. And that tears at our social fabric. So it's not something to blithely ignore. And Christopher Rufo doesn't. He's a contributing editor of City Journal. He's the director of the Discovery Institute's Center on Wealth and Poverty and director of the documentary America Lost, which tells the story of forgotten American cities. He starts, let's start with him, his piece on San Francisco entitled Chaos by the Bay, in which he writes, "The world of the well-off has become tightly restricted by public quarantine orders, and the world of the poor increasingly resembles that of Mad Max, lawless, crime-ridden, and devoid of functioning authority." Chris, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
With you, Dan.
Develop that description of San Francisco a little bit more, because you incorporate something that we've talked about on this show. We talked about it yesterday, actually, these prisoner release programs that are ongoing across the country.
Yeah, and that's really the starting point of San Francisco's policy. And I think if you think about what is San Francisco's response, it's first decarcerate. The new district attorney, Chesa Boudin, has released almost 50% of all county jail inmates. Mm-hmm. And the thing that you have to keep in mind, a lot of the rhetoric from criminal justice activists has been, we're going to release nonviolent drug offenders. But that only makes up actually 4% of people who were incarcerated in the San Francisco County Jail. About 70% are guilty of violent crimes, weapons offenses, and serious felonies. So by definition, he's releasing many violent offenders onto the streets in the midst of a pandemic under this mistaken idea of social justice, that somehow the people who are imprisoned are victims of an unjust system and systemic racism and all these problems. They're really using the coronavirus as a kind of cover to push through their longstanding goals of releasing people from prison. And now we're hearing calls that from activists that they want to release everyone from the San Francisco County Jail.
Wow. I mean,
I think is just a stunning development.
It's remarkable. And it also starts from this false premise that poor people, disproportionately minority families in poor neighborhoods in big cities, they don't want police protection or they're more interested in having people convicted of crimes released than they are in being protected by the police. That's just not true.
Yeah. And I think what you're seeing is that's happening right now is that as they are releasing folks from prison, they've also instructed San Francisco police officers to stop making arrests for anything but for the most serious crimes. And they've legalized tent encampments throughout the city. So, you know, it's home to roughly 8,000 to 10,000 homeless, many of whom have drug addictions, serious mental illnesses, criminal records. And they're passing out tents and basically saying it's a free-for-all. And the pattern that you see emerge is that the open-air drug markets, the crime, the burglaries, the drug overdoses, the tent encampments, they're not going in the nice and wealthy neighborhoods of San Francisco. They're going, again, disproportionately into poor and working-class neighborhoods, where people feel exposed, they feel vulnerable, and because the police department has basically stopped actively patrolling the streets, they feel even more in danger. And the big irony is that San Francisco has long decried social inequality as America's greatest evil, but their policies are actually deepening and perpetuating the exact social inequalities that they claim to be trying to reduce.
Well, in point of fact, I believe San Francisco is still number one in the nation in income inequality, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. It's right up there. Exactly. Yeah, and it's really kind of interesting. You have increasingly a two-tier society in San Francisco. You have a kind of technological tech wealth-driven elite that controls policy, and these are the folks that are in that kind of 0.01% of the income ladder. But they've adopted these social justice policies in a way to appease their own kind of internal feelings of guilt, and then to try to do something to be popular amongst the kind of progressive voters of San Francisco. But the policies that they've adopted, and these are folks like Mark Benioff at Salesforce, who's been pushing new taxes for the homeless, you know, the policies that they adopt often have the unintended consequence of making things worse and deepening and prolonging all of those other problems that they claim to be fighting. So what you're left with is there's a world where you have the wealthiest, most successful, and most progressive elites that live in the city of San Francisco, and then you have a class of 8 to 10,000 people who are living on the streets, addicted to drugs like heroin, methamphetamine, fentanyl, and just camping out in a kind of lawless order. So it really is the most striking social situation in the United States. And with the coronavirus, it's only becoming more pronounced.
And the juxtaposition this week of what you're describing with the Nancy Pelosi appearance on the James Corden late night show in front of her $25,000 refrigerator going through her stock of chocolate. Boy, couldn't be more timely, depending on your perspective, or couldn't be more tone deaf, depending on your perspective, since she not only is the House Speaker, but a denizen of San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really does represent just how out of touch folks are. And I think that that's essentially the problem, is that a lot of the policymakers, the kind of tech leaders, the even other business leaders in a city like San Francisco are so removed from the logic of life on the streets that the policies that they come up with that are intended to help often backfire because they don't have a ground level understanding. You know, I spent 5 years working on a film in America's poorest cities, talking to people in the poorest neighborhoods. And I can tell you with a high degree of certainty, folks like Mark Benioff at Salesforce, people like Nancy Pelosi in the U.S. Congress, have very little understanding of the actual operating culture and incentives and practices of life on the streets, of life in the poorest neighborhoods. They've kind of adopted this paternalistic attitude towards these folks that they want to help, but they haven't done the work of actually getting down on the streets, listening to people, and crafting real solutions that might actually solve the problem.
He is Christopher Rufo, contributing editor of City Journal, director of the Discovery Institute Center on Wealth and Poverty, and director of the documentary America Lost, which tells the story of forgotten American cities, as he was just describing. Chris Rufo, thank you for your insights. Good stuff. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
Listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. And boy, we have gotten some real tutorials in constitutional law this week from governors, well, and from the president, as I have argued on this show. But it was yesterday, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, who had this to say about weather conditions impacting your constitutional rights.
So we just had snow. I've got snow on the ground here in Michigan right now in Lansing. We're expecting, you know, up to 30 inches in the Upper Peninsula. The fact that we're cracking down on people traveling between homes or planting or landscaping or golfing really for a couple more weeks isn't going to meaningfully impact people's ability to do it because the snow will do that in and of itself.
So your constitutional rights are only relevant to the extent they're pragmatic? So they come and go based on weather systems. This is after Governor Phil Murphy of New Jersey, as we discussed yesterday, said that the Bill of Rights was beyond his pay grade. And when they had congregants of a synagogue arrested and charged for violating a state order, he was not thinking of the Bill of Rights. He was thinking of science. So the Bill of Science trumps the Bill of Rights. Now, whether whichever side of the argument you want to argue, you have to start from some sort of premise. And I would think we could get agreement on the premise that your constitutional rights are not weather dependent and your constitutional rights are not trumped by some gubernatorial manufactured bill of science slash data. Because those would be very interesting precedents, wouldn't they? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by David Rifkin. He practices appellate constitutional law in Washington, served in the White House Counsel's Office and Justice Department under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush, has litigated separation of powers cases, representing states and challenges to Obamacare and the federal Clean Power Plan. And he opined with a colleague, Lee Casey, in the Wall Street Journal on the topic of presidential power, but that necessarily implicates power at the state level as well. We're pleased to have Counselor David Rifkin present. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
How about those novel theories being advanced by Governors Murphy and Whitmer to start?
Absurd, to put it crisply. Look, this is not to say that in emergencies, including pandemics, state governors cannot impose restrictions on individual rights that are protected by the Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. There is precedent for that. We cite, of course, the famous Jacobson case that countenanced the mandatory vaccination in Massachusetts in the early 1900s when they had an outbreak of smallpox. And needless to say, invading somebody's bodily autonomy and injecting a person with a vaccine against his will is a pretty serious intrusion that under ordinary circumstances would not occur. So it is not that the governors cannot do anything here. They have formidable authority, but it is subject to review. I hope there would be judicial challenges to absolutely absurd exertions of authority. So, okay, we can argue about, you know, stay-at-home orders and social distancing as to how long we should last. But from what I understand about Michigan, and tell me if I'm wrong, things like you cannot go kayaking or you cannot buy paint or fertilizer or seeds are self-manifestly absurd.
Or you cannot go from
purpose to be served by them. And
right.
The last thing I'll say is that unfortunately in these trying times are bringing out, you know, kind of the worst in certain governors.
Yeah, no question about that. When we come back, I want to get to this issue because you have some diehard defenders of Trump saying when he declared himself Thomas Hobbes style, the absolute sovereign, that he does have the power to tell states they can open or you must close because of the enumerated power of regulating interstate commerce. Now, I've disputed that, but you're in a much better position to address it than I am. And also, per your piece, you suggest that actually the president and the governors are talking past each other a little bit, that they have complementary powers, competing but complementary powers when it comes to these shutdowns and reopenings. We'll have more with David Rifkin, appellate constitutional law practitioner, former White House counsel, former attorney in the White House counsel's office for both Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. More with Counsel Rifkin right after.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're talking to David Rifkin, who practices appellate and constitutional law in Washington, served in the White House Counsel's Office and Justice Department under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and has litigated constitutional matters like separation of power cases, representing states and challenges to Obamacare and the federal Clean Power Plan as well. And David Rifkin, let's start with your piece, go back to your piece in the Wall Street Journal. And you talk about how the president and governors are sort of talking past one another when they're arguing about who has the authority to do what with respect to reopening.
That's correct. There have been governors, and at least some governors, in essence, denying that the president has any ability to impact the continuing viability of various emergency orders that they've issued. There have been a number of op-ed pieces, frankly, I think most of them animated by Never Trump sentiments, which do not enhance one's legal abilities, to put it mildly. And then on the other side, you do have some exaggerated statements, including the statement, much as I admire the president, he does not have total power in this space. And the reason they're talking past each other, it is not a question of who has powers. Clearly, states have police powers. The Constitution left to the states. The federal government has limited enumerated powers, including the power to regulate commerce. The real question is, how do those two powers interact when they're in conflict? What we argue in our Wall Street Journal piece, that the president has statutory authority under something called the Defense Production Act. And then, as you know, he's used it in some instances, including ordering the production of ventilators by GM. Interestingly enough, his critics want him to do more. So let me explain briefly what the president can do if he wanted to. Whether he will do that or not, it doesn't appear to be the case now. He's relying on persuasion, but that's really driven by politics and policy.
Right.
As a matter of law, the president cannot compel states to reopen dry cleaners and beauty salons and restaurants. But any facility that manufactures things, any agricultural entity that grows things, packages things, any transportation, and in transportation sector, the president can basically use DPA to order those facilities either to produce new things or continue to producing what they've done before. If you were to do so under the Constitutional Supremacy Clause, any exertion of state power by the governors would have to give way.
But just on that point, and you note this in your piece, but I want to note it because I've noted on the show before, there are limitations to that as well, as the Supreme Court so decreed in the Youngstown Steel case with Robert Jackson essentially clipping the wings of Harry Truman.
Scripting. Yeah. Yes. But in the Youngstown case, the president was not only acting on his own. The president was acting contrary to the express statutory command in a statute that was enacted by Congress. In this instance, the president would be implementing the Defense Production Act that dates back to 1950 and had predecessor statutes dating back quite far in our history. So the presidential powers, we argue, would be at its apex. The president would be exercising the total power of the federal government writ large, both Article 1 and Article 2. And I have absolutely no doubt. Think about it for a second. So the president can issue a command to GM. The president can issue a command, I think it was 3M, the pharmaceutical right. company. If that is true, and it is true, and nobody's criticized him, people suggest that you should do more, he can issue a command to 100, 200, 300, however many, large and medium-sized enterprises in the transportation sector, in the manufacturing sector, in the agricultural sector, effectively overriding, with respect to those enterprises, any commands by the governors of the states where those enterprises found. So it's, you would have to, you know, you would not open the whole economy, but it can certainly open large sectors of the economy. I mean, it's not a difficult case to argue. I'm frankly surprised that nobody has pointed this out. And
well, again, I think people just look at it, you know, they want to look at it in total rather than in a piecemeal fashion. So as you point out, there are these industries that he could effectively open or close or repurpose, which would be more relevant.
Or let them continue doing what they're doing.
Right. But then there are other things, too, where, yes, the states and the local authorities have dominion over whether or not a park stays open or whether or not some local businesses and entertainment venues and so on and so forth stay open, that you can't make a colorable claim have anything to do with, for example, a national emergency responding to a pandemic. So I just think it seems to me people want to say it's, you know, it's all over here or it's all over there. And as you're pointing out, it's a little bit more nuanced than that.
And that's how things, if I mean, and that's how things actually work in our constitutionalism. It's very rare one branch of government has an absolute power, okay, because the framers wanted things to balance each other, to diffuse power, but yet do it in a way that's responsive and appropriate, for, particularly in emergencies. So, yes, the president does not have total power. The governors have no total power. And in certain instances, with respect to a large portion of the economy, if the president wanted to push his legal authority to the limits, he can override what the governors are doing. I don't think he's going to do that as a matter of policy. But it's useful to underscore, tell me if it makes sense, useful to underscore that he has this power. And I think that the people who claim otherwise are just wrong, and it's not a difficult issue. This is a joint enterprise.
Well, and the other thing, people should this is an opportunity to delve into just how expansive the president's power is in an emergency situation. There's been other write-ups on this, too, in terms of what more recent statutes trigger and what they could be interpreted to mean, including the regulation of communications or eliminating the ability of communication channels to operate, too. And now, obviously, President Trump hasn't gone in that direction, and good for him for not doing so. There was no need. But it is something that is arguably within his purview. And I think people just don't have an appreciation for how vast the power is.
That is correct. The same type of authority that the president has exercised in the context of trying to build the wall in the face of congressional resistance. Yes, Congress has delegated emergency powers that enable him to do, among other things, what he just described, impact them in way in which certain entities that engage in broadcasting and other activities operate. By the way, Congress also gave a president, let's say executive branch, but ultimately the president, enormous authority over banking. So another example, it has nothing to do with the Defense Production Act, but I'm sure most of your listeners noticed that not every branch of various banks is open.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think if the president wanted to, he can compel banks to open every single branch.
He is David Rifkin.
Give you another example.
Thank you for that. He is David Rifkin. He practices appellate and constitutional law in Washington, served in the White House Counsel's Office and Justice Department under Presidents Reagan and H.W. Bush, and has litigated a number of constitutional matters, including separation of powers cases and in representing states and challenges to Obamacare and the federal Clean Power Plan. David Rifkin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
Take care.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Cancel the antibody testing. Bring in the hounds. Remarkable story out of London. Dogs might join the fight to prevent the spread of coronavirus in humans. The only conversations about animals have been, you know, paying them to participate in, or paying those who provide animals to have animals participate in your Zoom calls to spice up those conferences, or the questions about animal to human, animal to animal transmission of the virus. This is dogs entering the fight. They may be good to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in humans, especially for the asymptomatic. This from a team of researchers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. James Logan, the head of the Department of Disease Control there, says it's very early stages, but we know diseases have odors. Diseases have odors, including respiratory diseases such as influenza, and that those odors are in fact quite distinct. There's a very, very good chance that COVID-19 has a specific odor. And if it does, I'm confident that dogs would be able to learn that smell and detect it. You know, obviously everybody knows dogs have a highly developed sense of smell, smell everything. The London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine has trained Labradors and Cocker Spaniels to detect malaria by sniffing. So maybe this doesn't sound as far-fetched as it seems. I see what I did. Yeah. Our previous work demonstrated that dogs can detect odors from humans with a malaria infection and with extremely high accuracy. above the World Health Organization standards for a diagnostic. It's amazing. Actually, it's remarkable. Although, who knows what the World Health Organization's standards are anymore. But anyway, think about dogs rather than tests to detect the asymptomatic, get a handle on the herd immunity, dogs riding herd over humans. It sounds like a Far Side cartoon. I love the prospect of this, though. So we'll certainly stay on this and make sure we throw you a bone if this does pan out here with dogs as the front line, the hero, potentially the heroes in assessing, and with emphasis, the asymptomatic population as it pertains to COVID-19 infection. Remarkable. Speaking of our good friends, not the canine kind, the colleague kind, like Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla, their hit political documentary, No Safe Spaces, number one political documentary of 2019, 99% audience rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It's good. Focuses in on the assault on free speech in American society today, on college campuses, on social media platforms, of course, in Hollywood. It is available to watch for a limited time, to stream for a limited time at nosafespaces.com. Hollywood doesn't want you to see it. That's why you should see it. That's also why it's not on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime. Get it at nosafespaces.com for a limited time.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us, danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes, Twitter, at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. Freddie Gray, friend of the show. He's a deputy editor of The Spectator. What do you do when you're in an argument with an impossible child who sees you as the enemy? Do you shout at them until you sound as unreasonable? Do you keep going back to them to hash out the key points? No, you do not engage. You walk away. You leave them to stew in their own rage. All parents know this. Trump is often called childish, petulant, and irascible at press conferences. He often is. His pride takes over and he ends up ranting. He takes the bait and the media revels in it. But what the media can't accept or understand is that the president versus media conference dynamic, it's the journalists who play the role of the teenage brat. They goad Trump until he flips, then gloat about how mad he went. It's President Trump who makes the mistake of sinking to their level. That's why he should shut down his press conferences now. I completely disagree. Completely disagree. I think on balance, the task force briefings are a positive. I think they do go on too long. He indulges the press too much. But I appreciate why he errs on the side of indulging them too much, because it's basically a sop to transparency. I sat there for an hour and a half and took all their questions until they were in their eighth iteration of the same questions they had asked in the first 20 minutes. This is your media. This is your press. This is your choice. Who is being a more honest broker? Who is outcome oriented? And who, as Freddie Gray writes, who is the teenage brat who doesn't want to do anything productive, just wants his or her way, doesn't matter, and won't listen to reason, fact, or anything else? Because I'll tell you what, you shut down the briefings, then you defang the president's bully pulpit. No one has used the bully pulpit like he has. It's not 100% positive from my perspective. And it varies day to day. Some days it's 60, some days it's closer to 80. But that's a pretty good value prop, 60 to 80% net positive on a daily basis. The bottom line is, forget the percentages. It is advancing the flag by taking the D.C. press corps flag. And remember, it's not just Trump there. You can't just remember the moments where he says you're a disgrace. You have to remember the full context. And people are watching it in context, even if the press wants to amplify the exchanges with individual members of the media. And that context includes Tony Fauci, includes Dr. Deborah Birx. It includes impressive members of the military or FEMA, who are the supply chain to the states, providing details and answering questions in detail. There is actually a lot of value-added information there. And when Trump rolls out, for example, his reopening plan, as he did yesterday, it's very helpful to have a guy that the press has elevated to Mount Olympus there to basically say, this three-phase plan makes sense, Tony Fauci.
In fact, mitigation works. You saw the charts that the vice president and that Dr. Birx put up. It worked. And what we hope, and I believe we will be successful, if we carefully do this, again, with the attention to the safety and health of the American public, that we will be able to. It will be staggered. Not every state, not every region is going to do it at the same time. That's clearly obvious because of the varied dynamics of the outbreak. But we feel confident that sooner or later, we will get to the point, hopefully sooner, with safety as the most important thing, to a point where we can get back to some form of normality. The one thing I liked about it that Dr. Birx said so well is that no matter what phase you're in, there are certain fundamental things that we've done that are not like it was in September and October. You want to call it the new normal, you can call it whatever you want. But even if you are in phase one, two, three, it's not okay, game over. It's not. It's going to be a way that we protect ourselves because, as we know, and as I've said from this podium, it may very well be, as we go the cycle around, that there'll be this virus that wants to come back to us. I think we're going to be able to handle that.
We're going to be able to handle that. And an endorsement of the phases, of course, which he was instrumental in cobbling together. So thinking about that, while Trump is fielding incoming from Pelosi and Biden and the usual suspects, Tony Fauci, who is suspicious in a lot of conservative circles, too, boy, doesn't he undermine the left's hysteria. You can't at the same time say, listen to Tony Fauci, and then say, don't listen to Tony Fauci when he disagrees with me for political reasons. That's a difficult argument to make out. And for people to say, well, just have the press conference like Dan Henninger, Wall Street, have the press briefings just with like the doctors and Pence and the supply chain people and Pence. Trump can do his own thing. It doesn't work that way. Trump needs to be seen with that group. He is the commander in chief. He is writing point on this. This is his task force, ultimately. And he needs to be seen interacting and complimenting as they are complimenting him. E-E-E-M-E-N-T-I-N-G, not I-M-E-N-T-I-N-G. Complimenting. In other words, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts together. For more on this, reluctant as I am to disagree, we're pleased to be joined by Freddie Gray, deputy editor of The Spectator, editor of Spectator USA, and host of the Americano podcast. Freddie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you. I've just heard you devastate my argument. So I don't know where to begin.
Exactly. all right. Thank you for joining us, Freddie Gray. No, I'm kidding. So I did lay out your argument, sort of the thesis of your argument, and I disagree with it for some of probably what you heard me saying. But go ahead and respond to what I cobbled together.
Well, when that piece got posted, I got quite a lot of stick online from people saying I was sort of parroting CNN. But, I mean, the piece, which you've obviously read, so thank you, is actually saying, you know, the pathetic party here are the media. I don't think Trump should get into these Punch and Judy games with them. I said Punch and Judy, which I think translates into American, even though it may be more of a British thing.
Yes, we receive you. Yes, you're coming in.
It's a sort of puppet show thing. And, I mean, I think that the briefings are important, and of course it's important that in a crisis a commander-in-chief is seen to be front and center, but I think they should certainly change the format and not allow these absurd kind of spats between journalists and Trump, which were kind of funny for a while but have already got quite boring even without the crisis, and now with the crisis they seem kind of tragic, really, I think. To not say Punch and Judy again, but there's a sort of strange Laurel and Hardy routine going on between Trump and Fauci in which they do compliment each other in this strange way. But again, it's the way that I'd say a weak point with the Trump presidency is that everything becomes a kind of TV show. It takes on that reality TV show dynamic that's discussed a lot. And while that is quite entertaining to a lot of people, it does start to wear people down, I think, in a crisis. And I think that might be reflected in some of the polling we're seeing on his job approval rating.
There's one other thing, too, that gets through at the task force briefings that wouldn't otherwise get through. Just information that even if it's reported, it's reported, you know, very quietly. It's not given the amplification that because it doesn't redound to the detriment of Trump. So, for example, questioning some of what the recommendations have been and questioning what some governors have done. We have studies now, both from Germany as well as China. And this is consistent. I spoke with Robert Verbruggen over at National Review last evening, consistent with what they're seeing in New York, too, that the incidence of transmission outside is almost non-existent. It is infinitesimal. Any evidence that coronavirus transmission outdoors, and yet you have all these shelter-in-place orders. And point of fact, what you find is infections of three or more are overwhelmingly occurring in closed-in spaces, like, you know, people, large numbers of people, families sheltering in space, and that's where you get the viral load, to borrow the phrase. And it's not when you're on a golf course or jogging along the lakefront in Chicago or in a park with your kid or on and on and on. And so some of what actually is included here should be challenged. And some of the orders that these governors have given at the state level should be challenged, at least based on, there's this word, science.
Well, I totally agree with you there. I think the media has gone from bad to worse to atrocious in recent weeks. I mean, I thought the New York Times burying that DHS study about how the infection had spread much more and therefore lethality was lower, and that's a government study that it put at the bottom of its story because the top of the story was sort of bashing Trump. I think we've seen so much of this, and it's just this pathetic inability of journalists, and I'm guilty of it too, but I try and resist it, of just putting everything through the same stupid filter or funnel of pro-Trump versus anti-Trump, or woke or not woke, whereas there's much more important stuff happening here, and people don't. You don't have to be a scientist to just try and report what scientists are saying, and I think a lot of people are failing there quite badly.
He is Freddie Gray, deputy editor of the Spectator, editor for Spectator USA, host of the Americano podcast. Freddie, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great pleasure.
Take care.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Let's talk a little bit of economics here, because there, of course, is a lot under discussion with respect to what the American economy looks like as we do reopen and we contemplate the lessons learned from this pandemic as well, and the government's response to this pandemic. And one of the most discussed topics in real time is about private sector supply chains, particularly those supply chains that include China in the chain, and what we should do about that. Of course, those who want to sort of refashion capitalism on the Republican side, I'm talking about, like Republican Senators Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio, are very concerned about businesses, American businesses, having any presence in China. And they want those supply chains onshored, ideally, or certainly somewhere else in Southeast Asia and not China. But Don Boudreau, friend of the show, asked some important questions about the supply chain discussion, as well as any proposed changes to it, government-directed changes, no less. Don Boudreau is an American economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and a regular contributor to Cafe Hayek, which is a good blog to read if you're interested in economic policy. Don Boudreau, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Happy to be back.
You start with some questions about people suggesting we should rethink what our supply chains look like, what American company supply chains look like, starting with this idea that we can't afford to have critical goods be produced in China or have America dependent on them being processed through China to our country.
Oh, I understand the concern, but the reality is, and it's a reality that I think most people don't grasp, there are no real supply chains. That's a misleading term. In fact, what we have today, for better or worse, we have a great global web of economic interconnections. Nearly every good, even the simplest one, and service, by the way, in a lot of cases, that we consume, has inputs from all over the world, has creative ideas from all over the world, and nearly everything we produce, and nearly everything people abroad produce, items of those things go into countless different other items, you know, down the production line. And so when we think of the term supply chain, conjures up this image that there are these distinct from raw material origins down to the final buyer, distinct chains. And that's just mistaken. This is just gigantic web. And for better or worse, you just cannot identify a chain. And when you try to identify a chain, it's like pulling a thread out of a larger fabric. You might get that thread, but you're going to unravel the larger fabric, and you don't know the kind of destruction that unraveling will bring about. That's what I'm worried about.
It's the iPencil Leonard Reed argument, or even more recently, on 60 Minutes, Danny Meyer, the founder of Shake Shack, talked about, you don't understand with respect to Shake Shack. It's not just Shake Shack. There are concentric circles around our businesses, from everything from the people who provide the flowers to other accoutrement of every Shake Shack restaurant, other restaurants I own, the concentric circles that radiate from around my business.
Correct. And this is not a matter of opinion. This is not a matter of ideology. It's simply a matter of fact. And it's a fact that has to be dealt with. And it's a fact that if it's ignored, when we think in simplistic terms, such as supply chains, we will do much more damage than probably whatever good will result from attempts to bring in these supply chains that don't exist.
Well, with respect to the goods that are moving through this supply web, to start using your terminology, we also have another definitional issue, which is what constitutes critical goods that the government should take an interest in ensuring in terms of its sourcing.
Correct. I mean, it's easy to say, well, you know, we should produce all of our critical goods, but who is to define what's critical? Food is critical. If we don't have food, we starve. So does that mean we should produce all of our food, if not all of our food? Which foods? Grains, but not maple syrup. Medicines. Obviously, some medicines are critical. If you're really sick, you need some medicines. Ventilators. All these. Everything that can be defined as being critical given some situation. And so if we're going to produce all of our critical goods, we need to have a reliable way of defining what is and what isn't critical. I don't know of any reliable way of doing that. We can turn it over to politicians.
Right. This is like essential employees and essential businesses. The problem is not defining what's essential. The problem is defining what isn't, because it's based on whose perspective, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I have a friend whose small business is being basically destroyed. He and his wife own a high-end boutique women's clothing store. And by his own admission, most people would not define high-end boutique retailing as essential. But he spends income buying inputs, buying computers. He employs people. They go out and spend money. You take that out, and that income stream and that employment stream is lost. We don't know exactly what effects that removing that income stream is having on the economy. It very well could be jeopardizing the integrity of some of the production of some things that most people do regard as essential or critical. I'm not saying it does. What I'm saying is we don't know. Nobody knows. And to pretend that we can just tell politicians, okay, look, you decide what's critical, you decide what's essential, you decide what's not critical, what's not essential, and then we can trust that everything will be taken care of. That's just very, very naive. That knowledge does not exist, and it will be made politically. Even if in principle it could exist, why would we trust politicians and bureaucrats to make decisions as if they are godlike angels, as opposed to the flesh and blood, politically motivated human beings that they are?
Well, the other thing that we're seeing laid bare during this time, too, where, you know, particular things are in short supply, where can we get more of this thing? We're starting to learn how these things work, how the supply web works, also the regulatory environment under which they must operate. And so, for example, this was buried in a Washington Post piece about grocery stores and empty shelves, because the Washington Post doesn't get it, of course. But with respect to you're talking about food producers repurposing food that is prepared for restaurants and instead to go to grocery stores. Well, nutritional labeling doesn't comply with the Ag Department's FDA guidelines for consumer sales. So Jeffrey Freeman, president and CEO of the Consumer Brands Association, makes the point that a company that sold hamburger buns to major fast food outlets could try to pivot to retail, but that entails changing packaging on the fly, a relaxation of labeling requirements, and new distribution contracts.
Right, exactly. These things are not anticipated ahead of time. I'm not saying they could have been anticipated, but you're exactly right to point this out as a regulation that I think is absurd. I see no reason why the market can't decide what should appear on a label and what should not appear on a label. Consumers aren't dumb. They want some information. They don't want all information. But when these are in place, it does obstruct the ability of the private economy to pivot and do what it ought to do in order to meet emergencies. So we have these government regulations standing in the way. We have opposition to so-called price gouging standing in the way. As I see it, the biggest obstacle to making things as smooth as possible. Nothing's going to make the world much better now at the moment. But the biggest obstacle are these government regulations and this what I regard as just the insane trust in politicians and bureaucratic mandarins in the states and local governments and the federal government to somehow know what should be done in a way that no one can possibly know what should be done. They just stand in the way. They just obstruct the ability of people on the ground to adjust using their own knowledge, their own information, their own incentives. That's being obstructed by these government rules.
He is Don Boudreau, American economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center, George Mason University. Don, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you. Country road, take me
home to the place. You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Earlier in the program, you heard from Brett Baer on the Wuhan Virology Lab and the investigation ongoing into the source of the viral outbreak. Hear from Condi Rice. Condi Rice interviewed by a Hoover Institution colleague asking about her experience with China as a security advisor to the president during the SARS outbreak.
One of the unfortunate similarities is it was also hard to get information out of China during the SARS outbreak. We knew that something had happened. It was very hard to get answers out of China of what had happened. And that is unfortunately a recurring pattern this time around. And it's probably the most troubling aspect of this crisis.
And she goes on to explain what China is doing now to cover up their cover up or to misdirect the cover up.
The Chinese are going to try to create, they're even trying to do this now, a counter narrative. Well, when we found out about it, we got on top of it. Look at how quickly, through social distancing and quarantine, look how quickly we recovered. And oh, by the way, we've been helping the rest of the world by sending PPEs and by sending help and aid to all of the world. They're going to try to shift the narrative from their initial responsibility for not fessing up to what was happening to we got on top of it and then we helped the rest of you. That's how they're going to try to shift the narrative. Don't let it happen.
Don't let it happen. And one of the people at the forefront of not letting it happen is Bill Gertz, national security correspondent at The Washington Times, author of Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. Bill, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hi, good to be on the program.
So when we talked to you a couple of weeks ago, we talked about all the things that now people are actually talking about. You were ahead of the curve on this, a piece you had penned in The Washington Times, that Chinese researchers had isolated bat coronaviruses near the Wuhan animal market, a Wuhan animal market. You were talking about a specific researcher, and you had specific details about him. And now we're hearing all the major outlets, some more pronounced than others, of course, talking about what was going on at that Wuhan virology lab and the possibility that that is the source of the source of origination for the virus.
Yes, the Chinese Communist Party is in full cover-up and disinformation mode about the origin of the virus. And the reason it's important is that without knowing where this virus originated and to get original samples, it's very difficult to deal with the pandemic. That is, finding therapies, finding a vaccine, dealing with any kind of future outbreak, dealing with mutations of the current virus. And the Chinese have totally stonewalled the rest of the world in revealing what they know. Worse than that, then they've tried to blame it on the United States. This is a serious issue. And as you said, people are starting to recognize that the idea that this just was happened by accident at a food market in Wuhan doesn't really pass the smell test. It's much more likely that they were working on a bat coronavirus, and we know that they've manipulated bat coronaviruses. They do something called a chimeric virus. That's a manipulated virus that you use for research, and they've done that research. But instead, what we're seeing is the scientific community and the mainstream media is basically falling in line behind Chinese propaganda to try and deflect it. They're trying to say it's impossible that it could have leaked from a lab, and that's because the scientific community has connections with the Chinese scientific community, and they're trying to get them off the hook, basically saying, look, it's a bunch of poor peasants at a food market that mishandled the food, rather than a technical mishap at a laboratory, which is supposed to be secure against dealing with deadly pathogens.
Let's talk about those connections when we come back. We're going to talk to Bill Gertz, continue with Bill Gertz, national security correspondent at The Washington Times, author of Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. More with Bill right after this. It's the number one political documentary of 2019. It's No Safe Spaces, produced by our colleague and friend Dennis Prager, as well as Adam Carolla, putting together a story of the assault on free speech that's happening in American society on college campuses, through social media platforms, of course, in Hollywood. No Safe Spaces details this. It also provides instruction as to what you can do to stand for free minds and free speech in a free society, that free society called America. Check it out now while you have some downtime. Watch it with the family. No Safe Spaces for a limited time at nosafespaces.com.
I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're speaking to Bill Gertz. He's the national security correspondent at the Washington Times, author of Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. We left off, Bill, we were talking about the connections in the scientific community, but our scientific community and the Chinese scientific community. I want to get to that in a second. But first, translate for me some of the pronouncements from senior level officials in the Trump administration about this suggestion that the virus originated in this Wuhan virology lab. General Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley saying it's inconclusive at this point. Secretary of State Pompeo saying what we do know is the virus originated in Wuhan, China. We know there's a Wuhan Institute of Virology just a handful of miles away from where the wet market was. There's still lots to learn. You should know the United States government is working diligently to figure it out. Do you think they know and they're just trying to buy time to maximize the political leverage they have with China, or there really is a question as to whether or not it originated from the lab?
At this point, it's a theory because nobody knows the origin, you know, and theories are basically scientific ways of explaining things. And there's no explanation for how this virus is caused a pandemic, which is devastating the world economy and killing thousands of people. And so, again, right now, the initial concern is to let's try and mitigate the damage from the virus. So there's a tendency by officials not to look back. The reason General Milley's comments were significant because it was the first time that a senior U.S. leader had addressed the issue that this thing could have come from a Chinese laboratory. Back in January 26th, I was the first to report in the Washington Times that it may have originated in a laboratory. And I was thoroughly denounced as promoting conspiracy theories and fake news. And it was, you could tell it was a deliberate attempt. It was not based on science or anything. It was I kind of call it the battle of the experts. All of our experts are saying it couldn't have come from a lab. Well, how do they know that? Because the Chinese have not been forthcoming. They initially agreed to provide samples. Furthermore, China has conducted extensive research on animal viruses and other zoonotic viruses to the point where they, in the last 12 years, they've uncovered 2,000 new viruses, including these bat coronaviruses. So for them to say that it couldn't leak from a lab, then you add to the fact that as Condoleezza Rice mentioned about the first outbreak of SARS in 2003, the Chinese have leaked that virus from some of their research labs. So it's beyond comprehension that any scientist would say it didn't leak from a lab, other than some political motivation to try to cover up or support the Chinese Communist Party propaganda line.
Speaking of political reasons to essentially provide cover for Chinese researchers or maybe even the Chinese government, the fact that study of the bat coronavirus and coronaviruses was in part funded by the National Institute for Health, specifically the Infectious and Allergy Disease Division. That's the division headed by Tony Fauci. In 2018, you had $3.7 million of U.S. funding, a consortium of funding from other Western nations as well, but $3.7 million from our National Institute for Health that was funding this sort of research at the Wuhan Virology Institute. And ultimately, apparently, according to Washington Post reporting, there was diplomats who became aware of what the conditions were at this virology lab in Wuhan. They believed the conditions were not properly secure. They sent cables back to the government in some form or fashion to somebody somewhere. And of course, it wasn't acted upon. What do you know about sort of that, the relationship there, our funding, and then where those cables went? Any accountability at NIH for what transpired?
Well, I would put it, you have to put it in a little bit of context here. And this is kind of the crux of my book, Deceiving the Sky, which is we had this 40-year gamble that if we just engage China and trade with them and interact with them and cooperate with them, that this is going to create a moderate, non-communist, non-threatening state. And it was an utter failure. And I think the scientific community was in the same. They were encouraged by successive Republican and Democratic administrations to cooperate with the Chinese. So we basically were and the reason that's dangerous is because, unlike here in the United States, in China, there's no distinction between military and civilian. They're completely combined. The factories that make refrigerators also make intercontinental ballistic missiles. The same is true for their research laboratories. And Wuhan, the Wuhan Institute of Virology is definitely involved in a covert biological weapons program. That's a fact. Hmm. And unless we get to the bottom of this, I think we're gonna be in a real big problem in dealing with China in the future.
But if cables were sent back to the U.S. government, I mean, ultimately, this is Tony Fauci's budget. This is Dr. Redfield's budget at CDC. They should have been apprised of this, right? Ultimately, they would be notified if there were concerns about the safety from a health professional perspective of that lab.
Well, the Wuhan Institute of Virology is a big complex, and within that is something called the National Biosafety Laboratory. So I don't know if that funding went to the secure lab. We just know that it went to the big complex. So I don't have any details on that funding, and I don't know when it went. The big laboratory, this National Biosafety Lab, again, it's a P4 lab, meaning that they can deal with the most dangerous pathogens. This was built by the French, and I reported in my Washington Times column, Inside the Ring, that the French hesitated in transferring that laboratory to the Chinese over concerns it would be used for biological weapons. And it was finally opened in 2015. The other thing is we've got to stop training these Chinese managerial, technical, and scientific people. We're training people that are now running these labs, and they're now working on viruses that could be used against us.
He is Bill Gertz, national security correspondent of the Washington Times, author of Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. Bill, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. To close the week, and as well as this show, some condolences and possible silver lining. Condolences, this is terrible news. The COVID-19 virus struck the Little Sisters of the Poor in the Lincoln Park neighborhood of Chicago, leaving four of the residents dead and 10 other people ill. All four residents who died were in the nursing home, according to the communications director for Little Sisters of the Poor. They run a convalescent home there. Of course, that's their charge. They were between the ages of 71 and 97. But Little Sisters of the Poor taking some hits over the last several years between fighting Obamacare and now this with the virus. So they do incredible work. These are incredible saints, really, all of them. And so we wanted to extend our condolences to what Little Sisters of the Poor are dealing with at the convalescent home in Chicago. Also, just to remark upon the passing of a great actor, Brian Dennehy passing away at the age of 81, not COVID-19 related. Obviously, people know who Brian Dennehy is from all of his film credits, but the last time I saw him on stage was playing Harry Slade in a reprisal of The Iceman Cometh. This was one in Chicago in which Nathan Lane played Hickey. This is about 8 years ago. And he was just an outstanding, outstanding stage actor in addition to all his film credits. And my favorite role remains playing the town sheriff in Rambo, the original Rambo, First Blood. Was great. So rest in peace, Brian Dennehy. Wanted to get to this David Brooks piece. Don't often invoke David Brooks, but sometimes he sticks the landing, and this is a case. He talks about, in his most recent piece in the New York Times, the age of coddling being over. Over the past decades, a tide of safetyism crept over American society. The goal was to eliminate any stress or hardship a child might encounter so he or she wouldn't be wounded by it. This spawned a wave of overprotective parenting, according to Brooks. I would describe it as parents choosing to try to shape the road for the child rather than prepare the child for the road. Big difference. And he points out examples of this. Schools banning dodgeball and inflating grades. Since 2005, the average GPA in affluent high schools has risen a quarter point from 2.75 to 3.0, so everybody can feel affirmed. It's certainly not because the work product is getting better. In point of fact, Brooks says it's been a disaster. This overprotective impulse doesn't shelter people from fear. It makes them unprepared to deal with the fear that inevitably comes. And maybe that's why we have an unprecedented response to not an unprecedented viral outbreak. Unprepared for the fear. It's those that were being prepared as well as the preparers, isn't it? And he contrasts this with the rigors of med school, where 60% of pre-med undergrads never make it through their major. That demands excellence because they have serious work to do. If it works for med school, pre-med majors, then why not apply it everywhere else to produce excellence? He concludes, I'm hoping this moment launches a change in the way we raise and train all our young. I'm hoping it exorcises the tide of safetyism which has gone overboard. The virus is another reminder that hardship is woven into the warp and woof existence. Training young person is training him or her to master hardship, to endure suffering, and by building something new from the wreckage, redeem it. Yes, well stated. Enjoy your weekend. Maintain your safety and your sanity. And join us again on the Dan Proft Show on Monday.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.